Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like. Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel and what's just a movie. Okay. Here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msoucy, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. You got a stripped-down version of the intro. If you see me on the street, I'll tell you about it. It's just work stuff, no worries. Well, friends, we got through another week. We will run the gamut a little bit this week. We'll grab a pencil and find out what you've been watching recently. We are going to dip into the archives this week. I'm very excited about this. So there is a new podcast up. I found it on Apple Podcasts. You can look and see where, I'm still working on where podcasts wind up, go, what have you, including my show. Anyway, backstage at the Vinyl Cafe, Jess Milton, longtime producer of the Vinyl Cafe, one of my favorite shows of all time, is the podcast. And so I'm going to replay my 2011 interview with Stuart McLean, who's just a lovely, lovely man, and I miss him dearly. So anyway, I'm happy to hear backstage at the Vinyl Cafe. They come out every Friday. So go check those out if you're a fan of the Vinyl Cafe. While I'm plugging other podcasts, Golden Globus Theater this week, they're doing Blaxploitation Month for February. This week is Trick Baby. So that's another film that I own in the collection. Very good con artist drama set in Philadelphia. I'm going to be a guest on their show next week to discuss the film Detroit 9000. So go check that out. Enjoy that. So, all right. Kind of a disappointing week when it comes to stuff I watched this week. There's a couple of new films, and I was getting through the pile of videos. We're going to start with the IFC thriller Consecration, which is Jenna Malone plays a doctor, a woman of science, as a nun calls her, who finds out that her brother priest has died under suspicious circumstances. Grace goes to Mount Saviour's Convent in Scotland, where he has been working as a priest. We find out early on that her brother, the priest, not only killed another priest, but then killed himself, jumping off of a cliff. And this is one of those cinematic, there's gorgeous footage of Scotland, and then we get into Creeptown, USA, as known as the convent. This is one of those cinema convents where nothing good can come from this place. The first time we see Mother Superior, nothing good can come from this place. To borrow a quote from my kid when they watched Hamlet, this isn't going to end good. Really morbid introduction of Mother Superior. And there's a timeline that is played with early on. We think that Grace is having visions, or are they flashbacks? This film tries to combine a few aspects. There is the don't go in the convent kind of story to it, which, red flags galore everywhere as far as the way the nuns treat her and the circumstances. There is that. There is a flashback that we find out the Jenna Malone character and her brother had some very traumatizing experiences as children, which could be another film in and of itself. And then as time goes on, there's also the faith thing. Grace is a woman of science. Jenna Malone is fine in this film, but she is butting heads with the nuns constantly. And as time goes on, she can't find her clothes, and there's this almost invisible barrier that is keeping her there. Now, part of it is the determination to find out what happened to her priest brother. But, this is a film that a full audience at the multiplex would be yelling, leave, get out. Here's another aspect. If you have a character who is supposed to be trustworthy at the beginning of the film, and as time goes on, you start to trust this person even less, don't cast Danny Houston. I like Danny Houston, and but man, it's also a dead giveaway from the get-go that nothing good can come from this. And eventually, near the end of the film, these kind of stories all wrap up together, and it didn't quite wrap up enough for me. I think maybe if they had stuck with one aspect of it, I probably would have liked it a little more. So, a slight disappointment for me. The film tries to do a swerve on if the power was in Grace all along, and was she a part of it? Was she always the caretaker? And I just couldn't go with it. So Consecration opens this week from IFC. That's a smaller mess compared to the film Knights of Swing, which I'll be doing a write-up on for the Film Yap. So we are in late 40s Los Angeles, 1947. Castle High School, where these young, not so young high schoolers, they look more like college grad students, if at best. But we have the setup of a white kid garage band with one African American trombone player. We'll get to that in a little bit. And it's interesting to see a garage band that's not a rock band. I think when you use the term garage band, you obviously think rock bands from the kind of 50s, 60s, and 70s. Because you've got a place to play. So I was loving this. Oh, we're going to see a jazz band in a garage, because that happens. It does. But, you know, you also have the kid who has the giant stand-up bass, and his dad can only drop him off using the pickup truck. And as they start to play, they have one big song at the beginning, Schoolroom Blues, and the Jam and Pajama Men are their name. They decide almost immediately that they want to form a big band, instead of the six-piece that they already are. And this gets the ball rolling. They are at this kind of special cinematic high school where everybody is acceptance of one another, more United Colors of Benetton than I would expect from, or maybe not, in Southern California in the 1940s. Your principal not only does the announcements, but plays piano and talks jive while doing it. This is like dream principal. And the guys in the band decide to not talk to their school teacher, their music teacher, who they think is a square, but their science and math teacher, Mr. Miller, who is very cool, according to these guys, and has big band connections. We're going to get to that plot point in a bit. And they ask him, he wants to form a big band. Mr. Miller is hesitant and turns them down initially. He goes home, drinks, listens to jazz, looks at pictures at Glenn Miller, who we find out, well, we know later on that this character is Glenn Miller's older brother. Of course, Glenn Miller died in 1939, if I remember correctly. And there is a surprise involving a Glenn Miller horn with one of the horn players late into the film, and they take this as a surprise. I thought, because he had big band connections, everybody knew that Mr. Miller is Glenn Miller's older brother, but apparently not. This film has small detail problem, and it gets in the way for me of the big picture. The next day at school, the boys go confront Mr. Miller. They ask him if he will be a part of the band, you know, music director, or help with arrangements. He turns them down. The boys leave. Miller goes to the radio, turns on the radio, listens to maybe 1 minute of a song, and immediately changes his mind. This is how fast plot points happen at times. And I'm getting to a worse issue with this film. So they start to audition singers. So we have one kid who plays horn and is a singer. There's another horn player who's a singer. But we have an audition for a female singer. Next thing I know, we're doing this in a band room with a panel, with a table of three faculty members, and I thought, okay, so when did we change this from being a school band, from a garage band to a school band? I think I missed that. I think the writers missed that. What then happens is you have a very self-assured, cocky female singer who thinks she should audition and they shouldn't audition anybody else. When she's not selected, complains to mom, and mom takes the torch of being the villain in this film. We don't see the daughter anymore. and winds up going on a protest saying that, you know, it's a waste of resources and taxpayers' monies to have this ban going in, an integrated ban as well, happening on school property. And eventually we have school board meetings that are met with in favor of the ban, but this woman cannot let it go. And she finds a couple other people, one who has some administrative power and a Southern accent for Southern California in the 40s, to lead the cause in stopping the ban. There's so much here. So my thought was they're going to form a band and try to get gigs around town. That seems a little more interesting for me, especially an integrated band. Now, granted, they're teenagers, and they would find out very quickly that there are limitations to this. The voting, I guess, so they can perform on school grounds, I guess that's needed. And they wind up getting a larger band, a more integrated band. There's even an Asian girl who plays, who's one of the band members. There's also a lot of band members in this film and only focus on a couple of people. I think even if you had maybe given everybody a little bit of a story, it'd be a little more interesting. We have a possible boyfriend-girlfriend situation between the singer, Guilford, and a horn player, and one of the backup singers. Guilford's older brother, who's back from war and suffering from major PTSD, is against the band as well. And apparently his older brother younger brother cannot listen in on older brother's activities going on in the house. And the only gigs these guys can get apparently are at school events, as opposed to, I don't know, public events, trying to sneak into clubs. It seems a little more interesting. But I get the, when it comes down to it, as I'm watching the school board meeting about where I just practice elsewhere, go somewhere else. And I think this is what kind of bugs me, Matthew Soucy, of bands I really liked went on the road. And they played 250, 200, 300 days a year and learned their craft. They didn't go on television. They didn't go on so-and-so's Got Talent and immediately become. And that's part of the issues I have with American Idol and all the offsprings that have come from that. And I think that this film shares that philosophy. You can only play the school dance, and then there's a huge climax about the battle of the bands. And then do they have insurance to go on the bus? And that's what the Southern accented guy kind of throws his hat in the ring. There's also a couple characters. We have an arrogant horn player who quits the band twice in this film and gets a clean polish at the end. The mom who, the racist mom whose daughter doesn't become a member of the band has a clean turnaround. I mean, Hallmark films would say, hey, slow your roll. Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland would say, there's way too much going on. Slow your roll. You can't do anything. You can't pull this off this fast. So there's a frustrating aspect to this where you could have had more focus on the band and the grind of trying to find gigs in the 40s. And then we get a Battle of the Bands climax that goes for 20 minutes. We get to see performances by the rival band. It's not really the rival band. They just were the defending champs. And then their performance. The music's fine. I love big band. I love swing. But it's too clean for me, that aspect. This film could have been a big band version of The Commitments, and instead it goes down the Glee path, and that's kind of a major disappointment for me. We could talk more about and there's some racial tension in the film, but you could go even further. There's Mr. Miller, who is the arranger, winds up having a nice little get together. He's a widower as well, but winds up having a deal with the local waitress. And by the way, man, this film is shot in nostalgic browns, and there's always sun beaming through the windows, and a very clean wood panel kind of malt shop that straight out of Archie Comics, where everybody is accepted. And there's no tension except for when the older brother with PTSD comes barging in, kind of like a brute version of Patrick Swayze in The Outsiders. But yeah, and then again, just we get some wrapped up bows for a couple characters who get a nice face turn at the end that for me doesn't justify it. And you can kind of figure out who wins at the end. But man, this could have been a lot more than what it was actually was. And the fact that it was 2.5 hours when you could have told more stories and tightened it up better somehow. But yeah, big disappointment of Knights of Swing. If you're into the music, that's fine. It doesn't quite have the success of That Thing You Do. There's a couple of songs that these guys do, Living on a Dream, if I remember the other one, where you know you're not sick of the song by the end of the film. That's the other part. This is an inexpensive film because they mentioned Louis Armstrong and Frank Sinatra and Glenn Miller, but there's no music of the period because that's just too expensive. But yeah, bummer there from Knights of Swing. Also out on video from MVD, The Return of Swamp Thing, which I had never seen before. And it's been a while since I watched Swamp Thing. You can actually go to Golden Globus Theater, check out their episode of Swamp Thing. That's one of Wes Craven's films with Adrian Barbeau and Ray Wise. This one, much more comedic in tone, much more cartoonish in tone. This Return of Swamp Thing makes the original Swamp Thing look like the Avengers. This is 1989. This is one of the first big starring vehicles for Heather Locklear after doing TV for most of the 80s. She plays the most beautiful florist ever. It's 1989. Loves plants more than men. There's a T.J. Hooker joke. And she also finds out that her stepfather is around and doing experiments, played by Louis Jourdan, who is less smarmy in this than he is in Octopussy. Sarah Douglas also works in Louis Jourdan's lab, which is always a good thing. He's working on some gene splicing and mutations. He has these bad kind of Rain That Wouldn't Die meets Island of Dr. Moreau experiments, and we find out, yeah, Heather's stepfather, she visits his compound somewhere in southern Florida, and things do not go well. Swamp Thing winds up rescuing a bunch of federal agents mulling through the swamp, attacked by one of the escape experiments. And then there becomes a relationship between Swamp Thing and Heather Locklear, which is very silly. And there's one joke where she says that she's a vegetarian, so it'll work out. I have to admit, that was the one laugh I had. We get some silly car chase shootouts. We have lots of soldiers in this film who cannot hit. They must have been trained by the A-Team bad guys. We also have two really obnoxious kids that have no business being in this film whatsoever and would have made the 87-minute film shorter and easier to swallow. Basically, they just want to photograph Swamp Thing when they're not trying to watch MTV and look at porno mags by themselves. And the other thing about this film, and maybe because it was the timing for me, this is from the same director that before this, before The Return of Swamp Thing, Jim Warnowski, he did Chopping Mall, Deathstalker 2, Big Bad Mama 2. You kind of get, and then we later do Transylvania Twist, 976 Evil 2, did both Munchie films, Ghoulies 4. So you kind of get, yeah, we're at B-level action when it comes to these films. And yeah, really tongue-in-cheek and really, really cartoonish. And it's out on MVD Blu-ray, The Return of Swamp Thing. Yeah. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Before we go into the archives, we have some dead people we like because we never have time for dead people we don't like. Salute to Burt Bacharach, who, you know, for some of us, we've literally grown up listening to his music and his arrangements. I could plow through all of the soundtracks. I'm not going to go scroll on IMDb, but nominated for What's New Pussycat for an Academy Award, nominated for Alfie, nominated for Casino Royale, The Look of Love, won the Oscar for Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, the most famous grinding halt of a film up until 1970, and he won an Oscar for Arthur's Theme, The Best That You Can Do. So salute to Burt Bacharach. I forgot to mention Cindy Williams passing away, and I know she's best known for television with Laverne and Shirley, but a great piece of trivia. She appears in two back-to-back Best Picture nominees, American Graffiti and The Conversation. And before that, appeared in films like Drive, He Said, Beware the Blob, I forgot about that, The Killing Kind, Mr. Rico, and I have to mention the first Nudie musical, because you should check that out. Also, salute to writer Russell Banks, whose two of his novels made into fine adaptations, and I believe he did both of them, The Sweet Hereafter and Affliction. To editor Robert Dalva, whose third work as a producer, or as an editor, he got an Academy Award nomination for The Black Stallion. He would later edit Raising Cain, Jumanji, October Sky, Hidalgo, Captain America, The First Avenger, Lovelace, and a few other films. So that's a salute to Robert. And then finally, Charles Kimbrough, who, yes, we know best as Jim from Murphy Brown, but he was also in the original cast of Company and Sunday in the Park with George. He was one of the gargoyle voices in Hunchback of Notre Dame. I had forgotten he was one of the committee counselors in the Martin Ritt film The Front with Woody Allen. Also appeared in The Seduction of Joe Tynan, Starting Over, It's My Turn, The Sentinel, Switching Channels, that's another one I remember him from, The Good Mother. So, yeah, this is another gentleman, stage, screen, television, Charles Kimbrough worked. So salute to you, sir. All right, we'll go around the horn, then we'll dip into the archives, and then we'll grab a pencil. So over at IU Cinema tonight, 7 o'clock, Friday, February 10th, is a part of the International Art House series, Decision to Leave, and then the Not Quite Midnight series at 10 o'clock, The Love Witch, with my buddy Jeff Parise. Decision to Leave is going to be on Saturday, February 11th at 4 p.m., and at 7 p.m., a new 4K restoration of the original Swept Away, Avoid the Madonna version by all means. Tuesday, February 14th, at 7 p.m., David Lynch's Mulholland Drive. Thursday, February 16th at 7 p.m., Rear Window. Friday, February 17th at 7 p.m., Solemn from 2021. And the 10 p.m., not quite midnight, screening of The Menu. Solemn's going to be played again Saturday, February 18th at 4 p.m. And then at 7 p.m., Saturday, February 18th, a new 4K restoration of Seven Beauties. And then Sunday, February 19th at 1 o'clock, Mapplethorpe, The Director's Cut. Tuesday, February 21st, 7 p.m., Malcolm X. All of that is happening over at IU Cinema at the Art Craft Theater in Franklin this weekend. If you want to see guys who are older than Fred Astaire, Google eyes over Audrey Hepburn. Check out Funny Face from 1957. That's at 2 and 7:30 p.m. this weekend. Moonstruck on February 17th and 18th, 2 and 7:30 p.m. All That Heaven Allows, February 24th and 25th, 2 and 7:30 p.m. at the Art Craft Theater in Franklin. Also want to mention the ribbon-cutting ceremony for Heartland Films, which is taking up their new offices at Arts for Lawrence, will be Wednesday, February 15th. Ribbon-cutting at 3:30, open house at 4 o'clock. All of that for Heartland Films at Arts for Lawrence. And at Can-Can, they still have Everything Everywhere All at Once, Women Talking, Infinity Pool, The Red Shoes are going to be there as well. And coming soon on the 11th, Hidden Figures, 50 Shades of Grey with Vanity Rex on the 11th, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes on the 12th and 13th. One day only, February 11th, is Decision to Leave. In the Mood for Love on the 14th and 15th. Fire of Love, one day only, on the 14th. Like Water for Chocolate on the 13th. And The Falconer on the 15th. All of that is happening over at Can-Can Indie. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. I mentioned before Golan Globus Theater. They are doing Trick Baby this week. Next week, I will be their guest on their show to discuss Detroit 9000. But we're going to hear a 2011 interview I did with the host of the Vinyl Cafe, Stuart McLean. And he's been gone for a few years, and I miss him dearly. Really good guy. I got to interview him for Film Sociology as well as the Blues House Party. But the podcast is called Backstage at the Vinyl Cafe. Jess Milton has been putting these together, and it's dipping into the archives with Dave and Morley stories and her telling a little backstage, peeking behind the curtain a little bit as far as the process of the shows or the particular episodes. I would love to get Jess on the show. And Jess, if you're listening, I'll be getting in touch with you soon. But with that in mind, we go to my 2011 interview with Stuart McLean. Enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology is the creator, the writer, the host, the man who is the Vinyl Cafe, Stuart McLean. He's going to be at the Hilbert Circle Theater Sunday afternoon at 2:30. How you doing, Stuart?
I'm very well. Thank you very much.
Good to have you back in town. This will be your second time in Indianapolis, and we heard you're going to be taping this time.
Yeah, we're taping in Indianapolis and in Cleveland on this tour, which is the first time we've ever toured and taped in the state. So it's a bit of a deal for us.
Well, we appreciate being a part of that deal. Why don't you tell us a little bit about at least some of the music and maybe a sample of the stories that are going to be done on Sunday?
We've got Luc Doucette and his wife, Melissa McClellan, touring with us. They're just back off the Sarah McLachlan North American tour. And before that, Melissa had been on the Lilith Fair. I think they've both been on Lilith Fair. They're both... what can I say about them? She's an amazing singer. She's just one of the great young singers in the country right now, and Luke is a fabulous guitar player. He's been playing with Sarah for 20 years as her guitarist. So they're great. Both of them are terrific musicians, and I'm really enjoying listening to them. Stories we got three stories. We got two brand new Dave and Morley stories and an old favorite to boot. The new ones. Let me see. One of them, Dave visits an old friend in a hospital and decides the guy needs to go for a walk, and so he busts him out of hospital and chaos ensues. And in the other one, Morley is clean. It's springtime and Morley's down in the basement cleaning out the just kind of giving the house a haircut, trying to clean things up a bit, and she finds an old doll in the basement that she doesn't remember, and that sends them both off, both Dave and Morley, off on a circuitous path through their memories, trying to figure out where this doll came from and who it might have belonged to.
Hey, I was curious. Do you get people yelling story requests at your shows?
Yeah, sometimes. Especially the turkey story is the one they like the most. If I give people a chance, they'll be asking for that one.
And then you have a 4-hour show.
We have about a yeah, exactly.
Well, going back a little bit, I was curious, do you remember the name of the movie theater in your neighborhood growing up? Do you remember going to?
Oh, yeah, there was the Kent Theater and the Avenue Theater. The Avenue Theater, which had rumored to have a private screening room where you could have birthday parties, but I was never, I guess it was a corral where they'd put kids in where they wouldn't, mess up with everybody else. But I never got to it. But in Montreal, actually, film wasn't a big deal for kids because there was a horrible fire in Montreal in a theater in the 1920s where 75 kids in a matinee were killed, were suffocated mostly trying to get out. It was one of those awful events where the doors opened in instead of out and an exit was barred. And in fact, that fire was key for making across North America, for making it imperative to have exit doors open outwards instead of inwards.
I see.
And in a complicated and political development, the Roman Catholic Church, which didn't like the idea of popular film and which more or less controlled Quebec, the province of Quebec, the French-speaking province of Quebec, used the disaster to get something that it had been trying to get for a long time, which was to keep kids out of theaters. So for close to 40 years, from the 20s up until the 60s, if you were under 16, you couldn't get into a movie theater in Montreal, where I grew up. Well, there was no Saturday matinees for kids. It was just they finally brought in at some point in the early 60s, they decided it would be okay to have family films. And kids could attend a matinee if their parents came with them. And I think the very first movie I saw was a Walt Disney nature film. It was the content was very carefully looked at before kids were allowed in. It was Perry the Squirrel, which was, I have to say, although I was very excited to be going to my first movie in a theater, was a bit of a disappointment because it wasn't Sinbad the Sailor Man or Davy Crockett or some of these other adventures I'd seen advertised in the movie pages. And, there you go.
It seems like it was even stricter than the Motion Picture Association of America here in the States.
Oh, it was totally. I mean, you just couldn't go into a theater. That was it. You were just not allowed in.
Now, was there a lot of, like, Sunday or Saturday afternoon television, like movies on TV?
Not that I remember, which might have been a good thing, you know, because television only really arrived in Canada. Our first TV was for the coronation. When Queen Elizabeth was coronated, people sort of went out and bought television sets so they could see that. But really, people didn't have TVs until the late 50s, so... We were told just to go out and play and go and play.
Boy, and longer attention spans.
Well, I've got a friend. You're right about that. I have a friend who works in television news who on his desk has a document where every year he monitors and keeps track of the average length of clips in news pieces. And I think when he started, the clip being, you know, the interview section of the of the piece where the reporter would throws to you know, the politician who has something to say or whatever, or the grieving widow or whoever you got in the story. And he said that in the 60s they used to be 30 to 40 seconds long, and now they're under 10 seconds, these clips. So everything has to move so much faster today.
Now, did you guys have a lot of – were there a lot of drive-ins in Canada?
Now, that's funny you should ask that. I was in Austin, Texas last week. And I went to an urban drive-in in the middle of downtown Austin. A drive-in in a real seedy part of town, where room for 13 cars, and but with all vintage equipment, vintage hookups, and we sat in our car and watched Beach Blanket Bingo.
Oh my!
And ate vintage candy in this industrial part of Austin. It was fabulous. No, going to a drive-in was always my great desire. There were because once again you weren't allowed to go to those. But I finally had my dream come true in Austin last week.
One of the things that's always been noted is it seems like the U.S. film industry has always overshadowed a lot of going on of what was happening up in Canada. When did that begin?
Well, the Canadian film industry kind of began during World War II. A guy by the name of David Grierson, there were films made before that, but a guy by the name of David Grierson was famously brought over from England to set up the National Film Board of Canada.
Which was formed in 1939.
And it was begun as a kind of a propaganda arm, really. It was there to produce films to encourage patriotism during World War II. But it very quickly, after the war, morphed into this hotbed of creativity and became, because of Grierson, famous for its, for a documentary film is what it first became known as, and then for animation. The NFB was made a lot of Oscar-winning animated shorts and a lot of great documentaries, and Canada and Canadians have had a long history of being very strong in both those things, and have peopled a lot of American documentary shows over the years. Have provided the talent for that, but we've never really developed in the way that America or even say Australia has a strong feature film industry. We've turned into of our own with a strong Canadian identity. We've ended up becoming a service industry. We're known as Hollywood North,
right.
And a lot of American productions will come to Canada and work with Canadian studios, with Canadian, you know, on Canadian lots and Canadian with Canadian directors, actors, whatever. But they are largely American-driven films. For a while, they came up because Canadian dollar was lower than the American, so it was economic for people to come to Canada to shoot films. And in the Canadian side, it was thought of as a way we could develop the industry, but the Canadian industry never developed. You know, we're not telling our own stories.
Right.
We're telling your stories more than ours.
Well, I remember reading a piece on how there were two films that were an example of that, of not showing the Canadian identity, even though it was a massive amount of Canadian work. One was Porky's, directed by Bob Clark. I think Bob Clark directed that,
mm-hmm.
and Meatballs with Bill Murray. And I think they said the only Canadian identity was a Canadiens jersey on a wall.
Well, and that's the problem is we don't have distribution. It's very interesting. The music business, we're a small country. I mean, we're a huge country, but we're small geographically, but our population is small. And the music business, the government policy, public policy became, they recognized that in order to build a Canadian music industry, they had to support it. And the way they supported it is it became law. There was legislation made that radio stations in Canada had to play a certain amount of Canadian content.
Mm-hmm.
And they grumbled about this at the beginning. At first it was 25. It ranges between 25 to 50% Canadian content music, depending on the type of station and the type of music. And the definition of what Canadian music is fairly broad. It has to have a certain component of either recorded in Canada, written in Canada, performed by Canadian musicians, sung by a Canadian singer. You don't have to hit all four, but you have to get a certain percentage of those four.
Mm-hmm.
And because this existed, and because Canadians therefore started hearing Canadian music, Canadian stars started to emerge, because musicians could afford to stay in the business, and if you've got enough people doing it and making their living doing it, finally those stars will emerge. And that's why people like Katie Lang and Joni Mitchell and Randy Bachman and Leonard Cohen and came out of the fog. They wouldn't have existed unless this support had been there. That never happened with film.
It didn't happen at the multiplexes.
The movie theaters weren't forced to show the Canadian movies. So any kind of small Canadian movie that might have emerged, like you saw emerge out of Australia, didn't happen. And we became the service guys for the American, for Hollywood. And therefore, we became Hollywood North rather than Canada, and we were producing Meatballs, and as you said, instead of some small movie that might in some way tell the story of who we are, and not in an earnest way, but in a fictional way, the way movies can do that.
I would say, how big of an impact were the tax shelter films of the 70s and 80s, or was this?
Well, the government realized they had to do something to support movies. They went at it that way instead of the distribution. And so if you invested in a movie, you got to deduct it from your income tax. So everybody was making – you could make these $10,000 investments in a movie, and in the first year you get to write off $7,000, and the second year you got to write off another $7,000, and therefore you got your money back without the movie having to make money. And what happened is nobody cared what movies they were making. They just cared that they got these, that movies were being made you could invest in. And the emphasis went on the deal rather than on the film itself. And so lots of movies were made while these tax shelters were going, but they were movies that nobody wanted to see.
Well, I actually wound up seeing a few of those as a kid. And I know, I think it was discovered in 1979 that more than half of the 66 Canadian-produced films weren't even released.
But they made investors very happy because they got their tax credits. Well, it's a very interesting to compare the different attempts at government trying to manipulate public policy in order to affect the artistic world and to try and support the artistic world, and how it succeeded in the music industry in creating this homegrown music industry, and how it's also succeeded in the film industry, because there is a vibrant film industry in Canada, but it isn't telling our stories. It's servicing Hollywood as opposed to telling the Canadian story. And when you listen to, when you listen to Joni Mitchell, when you listen to The Band, when you listen to Leonard Cohen, you can tell they're deeply involved with their Canadian roots. And are reflecting the country in some way, but the films aren't.
I think of a couple directors, and you mentioned earlier there's a number of actors and directors and producers who, originally are from Canada and then moved to the United States. And, everybody from Ivan Reitman to David Cronenberg. But two directors I think of, if you want to have a Canadian director, I think of Adam McGoyan and Guy Madden. How are they looked upon regarded highly in Canada?
Well, they're regarded highly by critics.
Right.
And they're regarded highly by film festivals, but their films don't. Aren't in wide distribution across the country, and I mean those guys are not making films that would necessarily
open in 3,000 screens.
No, they're making more idiosyncratic and many would say interesting films, but they're not making those. You see, that's what we've got. We've got and on the other end of the spectrum, James Cameron. Who made Avatar and Titanic, the two largest grossing films in history? He's a Canadian, but he's not making Canadian stories. So we have both ends of the spectrum covered. We've got the guys who've developed through the Hollywood studio end of things, and we've got the artistic small film being made. But we don't have the guys in the middle, the men or the women in the middle of the road making, or in the middle of the pack making small popular movies that reflect our story.
So we're not going to have James Cameron doing a film version of the Trailer Park Boys.
Well, he might, but it'll be a toss off. It'll be something that he does at some point in his career to, because his conscience is nagging him.
Right. Are you familiar with a website called Canuxploitation?
No, I'm not.
It's a guide to the B movies from Canada from like the 50s through the 90s.
That sounds like fun.
Well, it is, because I was going through some of these, and as a kid, I saw some of these films in theaters, saw them on video, saw them on cable, and only as I got older and more into this business, I found out that it was a Canadian-made film. Films like the original Black Christmas, which I know is a cult classic for horror fans, The Changeling, The Brood. Obviously, a lot of these are horror films, but films like Space Hunter, Adventures in the Forbidden Zone, I remember seeing that as a kid. Even in my hometown of Flint, Michigan, we got The Gray Fox, the Richard Farnsworth Western, which I thought was just fantastic.
And that was a great movie, and that was well seen across Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the exception that proves the rule. That's that's the sort of film that I'm talking about that we should be making more of.
And a film like Black Robe, which did a better version of the Dances with Wolves story. So, Stuart, I'm curious, do you get to see any movies when you're on the road, and how often do you get to see stuff at home, when you're at home?
These days, do I get to see movies on the road? Never. Occasionally we have a night off, but usually if we have a day off between shows, it's a travel day, and we're moving from one place to the other, and we'll be on the bus for 10 hours. And by the time you come to the hotel, if you've been traveling on the bus all day, the idea of going and sitting in a movie theater just isn't what I feel like anyway. You tend to just want to settle down in your room and read or go for a walk. At home, I'm a writer these days, is how I spend most of my time, and I seem to always be on a deadline. Which is a writer's best friend. I'm not complaining about being on a deadline. I think when people ask me about what's my advice to being a better or being a writer, I always say find yourself a deadline, because it's what will make you sit down in your chair and get writing. And a deadline can be anything. It can be an assignment from somebody. It can be a creative writing class. It can be a writing group. Whatever it is, it just has to be something that forces you to produce. So I find that I'm spending a lot of my time producing. I did, however, for Christmas, make my sons a little book this year, where I sent them a book with my favorite movies of all time, and with a little explanation as to what each movie was and why it was important to me. And so I have been thinking about the films of my life and realized during the exercise that movies had been more important to me than I thought.
Can you give me a sample?
Gee, now I got to. I thought to myself, oh, my goodness, now I open my mouth, I'm going to have to
say something.
Say them. Well, I mean, my favorite movie of all time was Lawrence of Arabia. That was on the list of 10. There was a movie called The Flim Flam Man
with George C. Scott. Yeah,
you know it.
Oh yeah, yeah, con artist film.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I was a bit of a con artist myself as a young guy, and it was. I think that movie resonated with me. In a big way, because I'm so impressed that you know it, because I went to see it without knowing what it was about, and and it just had this great. It spoke to me, and it was about a con artist who took a young lad under his wings and taught him the game, and I desperately wanted to be that young boy.
Go, I'm sorry, go ahead.
You go, no.
Well, I say I had a similar feeling, and this is another example of I saw the film not knowing it was a Canadian film, but enjoyed it nonetheless, was The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz.
No, I haven't
seen
Richard
Dreyfuss.
One.
Yeah, and I know the author of that film had another one of his books was made into a movie last year, Barney's Version.
Yes, that's right. Another one of Richler's book was made into
yes,
a movie. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah, that was a Barney's Version is a great book, and that I haven't. I'm looking forward to seeing that movie. I haven't seen that seen it yet.
I haven't read it, but I thought Giamatti was excellent in it, and I really, really enjoyed it. In fact, it looked like something Richard Dreyfuss or Dustin Hoffman would have starred in 40 years ago.
Well, that's great to hear. It's a great book, actually. It's if you feel like a read, but I'm glad to hear the film's good, but the book was great, too.
Cool. I'll be on the lookout for it. Now, you were going to say something.
Oh, I was thinking of the other films. Another one that was on my list, and these were not films that I put on the list because they were necessarily great movies, but because they spoke to me in a important way at a different, you know, different parts of my life. Mm-hmm. Another one was a little documentary. We're talking about documentaries made in the '60s out of California called Skater Dater, which is a 12-minute movie with no dialogue, which actually I learned later as I was kind of researching the thing to tell my boys about it. I either won or was nominated for an Oscar as the documentary of the year, and it was a piece about little boys learning how to skateboarding in somewhere in California, and then one of them seeing a girl on a bicycle and being diverted to her as he grew, you know, as his loyalty to the group of skateboarders was challenged by the pretty blonde thing on the bicycle. It was a lovely little movie, and I just watched it the other day. It's very fun. It's a fun exercise to go through, to try and go through the movies of your life and choose 10 which are the movies of your life that spoke to you in some way. And then to find them. It's hard to find these films.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, with the Canucksploitation website, yeah, a lot of these films are not on DVD. I think part of it is maybe who owns the rights to what and how do you convert them. But, yeah, there's still a number of films, no matter where they're made, that haven't made it to DVD or Blu-ray or online yet. So there is still a bit of a hunting feel, I guess, kind of like going into a record store and looking for an old album that's out of print.
Which makes it all the more fun.
I agree. Yeah, so the search keeps going, I guess.
Well, for me, and that's because I've told them I'll get them all the movies, and I think I've got four or five so far, and I'm looking for having that as a little project and on the back burner is kind of fun.
Well, in baseball, you're doing great.
Well, you're right.
Hey, just curious, what do you think? What are some of the movies Dave and Morley would probably watch?
Well, Dave would probably be watching Meatballs. Proudly. With a Canadian beer in his hand.
Sounds like my college days.
What would Morley be watching?
I mean, do we do standard romantic comedies? Or, you know, they'd have to fight over what they're going to go see, what they're going to watch? Give and take, as a lot of spouses do.
You see, now you've given me some food for thought here. I can't answer it, but I think I'm going to try.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think they would like romantic comedies. I think they, you know, Sleepless in Seattle and what are some of those Hugh Grant movies? The,
right, Four Weddings
Love
and
Actually,
a Funeral, Love Actually. Yeah, Love Actually was just on cable last night. I think it's on a 24-hour loop. It's law, apparently. Well, Stuart, I really, really appreciate your time. And I guess you always try to get Canadian musicians on your show. I'm waiting for you to put the band Anvil on your show someday.
Okay. I think don't hold your No offense to the band Anvil. I don't even know them. But I fear that just the name sounds like it won't be – they won't – God love them. Won't be on our show.
Canadian metal bands that are in their 50s? No. Well, it was worth a shot.
Well, maybe we could do them Unplugged.
Hey, there you go. I mean, it's a really fine, fine documentary. It's called Anvil, The Story of Anvil.
Yeah, I think I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's some people have said if Spinal Tap were real, but it's a sweet story because you have these two, especially the two original members, who have been slugging it out in the music world for over 30 years, and they won't give up. It's very inspiring, but there's a lot of loud music and silliness along the way.
Well, I'll add it to my list.
From 2011, that is Stuart McLean, host of the Vinyl Cafe. Stuart died in 2017. Oh, my God. It was February 15th, 2017, so we're coming up on it. The new podcast, Backstage at the Vinyl Cafe, it's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. If you're a fan of the Vinyl Cafe, and I hope you are, or if you're new to it, go check it out. I'm happy to say that, and kudos to Richard Miles, WFYI, I believe, was the third public station in the United States to carry the Vinyl Cafe. I want to say it was Minnesota, Oregon, and then us. So, and we had a few Vinyl Cafe shows in Indianapolis. I would always do a Canadian blues house party when Stuart was coming to town. I should probably watch the Flim Flam Man next week in his honor. So, yeah, look for the podcast Backstage at the Vinyl Cafe. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Okay, friends, grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching this week. And we start with Amanda, who I got to see, Lynn and I got to see her at the Phoenix Theater. There's a really fun one-woman show called Wild Horses. It's being done by Jen Johansson and Constance Macy. You have to check out both because you have a rare opportunity to see a one-person show done by two different artists. So, and it's a nice compare-contrast. So check the listings and check who's performing, but check out both if you can. That's over at the Phoenix Theater. Anyway, I got to see Amanda there. She always delivers. She watched The Princess Bride, Wildcat, very intense documentary of a young man's love of animals in the rainforest, and Knock at the Cabin. Lou Harry writes, Alice at the Palace with a very young Meryl Streep, Every Act of Live, documentary on Terrence McNally, and that J-Lo hostage rom-com. Thank you, Lou. Tom writes, the Pez Outlaw documentary, deems it really fascinating. Okay, Kevin. Kevin writes, genius, and then in parentheses, some mistake this for the Matthew Soucy story, but it's actually a film about Thomas Wolfe. Thank you, Kevin. Very cute. Nick Rogers writes, Guns and Guts, Hard Rock Zombies, The Hit, and Sharper. Britt writes, Thor Ragnarok and Thor Gods of Love and Thunder. Okay. Judy writes, What Happened, Miss Simone? Facing Nolan. Well, it is spring training time. It's about Nolan Ryan. And Wakanda Forever. Thanks, Jude. Jamie writes, The Lorax, Iron Man 3, Wakanda Forever, Disney's Robin Hood, Encanto at the Hollywood Bowl, and The Land Before Time. Eric writes, Marty and Idiocracy. Loved Marty. I've learned that I'm just not a Mike Judge fan. As I mentioned, I love Marty. Marty was one of my bucket list roles, one of my dream roles. I'm now too old to play Marty. That happens. I also forgot that I used there's an exchange in Marty that I used in the intro, the early, early intro of Film Sociology, where Marty and his buddy Ange are saying, what do you want to do tonight? Eric, just remember, Idiocracy is a documentary, so check that out. But no, I'm sorry you're not a Mike Judge fan. I am. Eric writes, a light week for films while doing other stuff. Fassbender's Ali Fear Eats the Soul. Whew. And the American Experience documentary Zora Neale Hurston Claiming a Space. Jennifer writes La Diabolique and The Outsiders. Alan writes Me to Play, a documentary of two older New York actors who attempt to work with or through their Parkinson's disease with a single performance for a single performance of Beckett's Endgame. Courageous and humbling. Thank you, Alan. Anne writes Living and the Fablemans. More people need to see Living. I love that film. Kristen writes Emily the Criminal. It was real good. Doug writes An American in Paris, Kiss Me Kate, Coolie High, and more from 2022. Bardo, False Chronicle of a Hatful of Truth, and of a Handful of Truths. Bros, The Elephant Whisperers, Haul Out, Living, The Martha Mitchell Effect, and Stranger at the Gate. Krista writes Infinity Pool. I hoped for more from it. Okay. Josh writes The Death of Stalin. JJ writes The Man with the Golden Gun, Diamonds Are Forever. Arctic, surprisingly good, Mad Mikkelsen, Man Stranded Fic. I saw that, JJ. Yeah, he puts himself through the ringer in that one. And 1965 film The Possessed, Proto Giallo. Adam writes The Conversation. Jessica writes Meander and Bed Rest. Daniel writes Singing in the Rain, Ideal Home, Man's Favorite Sport, Goldfinger, and the John Huston version of Moulin Rouge. Zachariah writes Streetcar Named Desire, Women Talking, Megan, Vortex, and Hatching, or as Mr. Garvey calls it, Mathregan. Kevin writes the Picture Taker documentary. David writes John Wick and Fury. Helen writes Elvis. Gary writes Punk the Capital, Building of a Sound Movement, Punk Revolution NYC, Baby, Manhattan Baby, Train to Busan, Octopussy, hey Louis Jordan, The French Teacher, Eloise, Puppet Master 2, Ruby on Riff Tracks, is this the Piper Laurie film? Really? Akira, and Knock at the Cabin. Rachel writes Disney's live-action version of Mulan. Don writes Elvis and Shotgun Wedding. That's the J-Lo rom-com thing. Jeff writes Tar and Everything Everywhere All at Once. Gene writes Everything Everywhere All at Once. Patty writes Captain Blood, My Fellow Americans, and Mr. Hockey, The Gordie Howe Story. Thanks, Patty. Taylor writes Amsterdam, Pirates of the Caribbean 4, and The Thin Man. Kurt writes The Bourne Identity for Saturday Night, The Music Man for Sunday Night at Belle Trace. Two films where we never quite sure we figured out the real name and background of the lead character. Ah, look at that, Kurt. Very good. Hope to see you on Drinks with Dee Dee, and please give Snickers my love. And finally, Beverly writes Banshees of Inisherin. And there you go, friends. That's what you've been watching this week. So hopefully you got to watch some good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. We'll go back next week. Don't forget, Golden Globus Theater this week. They're doing Trick Baby. I'll be their guest next week for our talk of the film Detroit 9000. So we love blaxploitation here at Film Sociology and Golden Globus Theater. So, yeah, check that out, and we'll do this again next week. Thank you for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!